Those generals who disagreed with the White House policy were undercut and sidelined. Those who supported it enthusiastically were promoted, even though it has been a catastrophic failure at every turn. Future management gurus may eventually write about a W deviation to the Peter principle. When someone has clearly been promoted to the level at which his incompetence is on flamboyant display, present him or her with a medal of freedom and assign him or her even more responsibilities. For 5 years, there has been a growing tension between President Bush's portrait of the situation in which we find ourselves and the real facts on the ground. In fact, his entire agenda collapsed around his ankles. What is left of the Iraqi state is also collapsing, with a growing U.S. casualty rate and a multi-sided civil war, with the attendant chaos and risk of an Islamic fundamentalist state or failed state that breeds terrorism for years to come. The conservative talk show host Tucker Carlson said about Bush's Iraq policy, "I think it's a total nightmare and disaster, and I am ashamed that I went against my own instincts in supporting it." Doug Bando, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, a veteran of both the Heritage Foundation and the Reagan White House, wrote in September 2004, "Serious conservatives must fear for the country. Conservatives should choose principles over power." He seemed most concerned about Bush's unhealthy habits of mind. "He does not appear to reflect on his actions," Bando wrote, "and seems unable to concede even the slightest mistake. Nor is he willing to hold anyone else responsible for anything," Bando continued. "It is a damning combination." He described the Bush foreign policy as a shambles, with Iraq aflame and America increasingly reviled by friend and foe alike. William F. Buckley, Jr., widely acknowledged as the founder of the modern conservative movement, wrote of the Iraq War, "If I knew then what I know now about what kind of situation we would be in, I would have opposed the war." One of the central points of this book is that we as Americans should have known then what we know now, not only about the invasion of Iraq, but also about the climate crisis and what would happen if the levees failed to protect New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, and about many other fateful choices that have been made on the basis of flawed and even outright false information. We could have known, and we should have known, because the information was readily available. We should have known years ago about the potential for a global HIV/AIDS pandemic. And the larger explanation for this crisis in American decision-making is that reason itself is playing a diminished, less respected role in our national conversation. The war against terrorism manifestly requires a multilateral approach. It is impossible to succeed against terrorism unless we have secured the continuing, sustained cooperation of many nations. And here's one of my central points. Our ability to secure that kind of multilateral cooperation in the war against terrorism was severely damaged by the way we went about undertaking unilateral action against Iraq. The 9/11 attacks prompted most Americans to wrestle with the question of what our country needs to do to defend itself. At the earliest signs of what President Bush and his national security team had in mind for Iraq, I argued that an invasion would only weaken America's security. We should have focused our efforts first and foremost against those who attacked us and who thus far have gotten away with it. I never believed that we should allow ourselves to be distracted simply because tracking down Osama bin Laden was more difficult than anyone predicted. Great nations persevere and then prevail. They do not jump from one unfinished task to another. Once we pushed the Taliban out of power, I believe that we should have had a force of up to 35,000 international troops to come into Afghanistan, as we did in Bosnia, and say, in effect, "There's a new sheriff in town, calm down." And after a while, their blood pressure would have gone down, and their general expectation of violence and conflict would have been replaced with a general expectation of cooperation. That was not done in Afghanistan, even though many in our military were in favor of it. Back in 1991, I was one of a handful of Senate Democrats to vote in favor of the resolution endorsing the Persian Gulf War. I felt betrayed by the first Bush administration's hasty departure from the battlefield, even as Saddam began to renew his persecution of the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south, groups that we had encouraged to rise up against Saddam. After a brilliant military campaign, our decision to abandon, prematurely, the effort to destroy Saddam's offensive military capability allowed him to remain in power. This precedent should have been debated and discussed by the Congress in 2002. The Congress should have required, as part of any resolution regarding the proposed invasion of Iraq, explicit guarantees relating to the aftermath of a military victory. I first spoke against the regime of Saddam Hussein in the fall of 1988, soon after he used poison gas against a minority within his own people. My father's older brother had been the victim of poison gas in World War I. Because of that, my family's oral history has always emphasized the horror of those weapons. The World War I generation impressed that same lesson on peoples around the world. We went through all of World War II without poison gas, save some horrible experiments in the Far East. When Saddam became the first to break the taboo, it set off alarm bells. It is instructive to look at the differences between the decision to expel Iraq from Kuwait in 1991 and the decision to invade Iraq in 2002. To review a few of the differences briefly, in 1991, Iraq had crossed an international border, invading a neighboring sovereign nation and annexing its territory. By contrast, in 2002, Iraq had not invaded a neighbor. On the contrary, we were the ones who crossed an international border. The difference in the circumstances had profound implications for the way the rest of the world viewed our policy. Another difference: in 1991, the United Nations passed a resolution supporting our response to Saddam. In 2002, we went to the United Nations to ask for a resolution supporting our invasion, but were not successful in getting it. In 1991, the first President Bush patiently and skillfully put together a broad international coalition. His task was easier than the one that confronted his son, in part because Saddam had invaded another country. For whatever reason, most Arab nations, except Jordan, which is in Iraq's shadow next door, supported our military efforts and were a part of the international coalition, and some of them supplied troops. Virtually all of our allies in Asia and Europe supported the coalition, materially or vocally. In 2002, however, most of our allies in Europe and Asia openly opposed what President Bush did, and most of the few who did encourage us initially conditioned their support on the passage of a new UN resolution. Even had President Bush been correct about his contention that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, his approach to dealing with it was the wrong one. As I said before the war in 2002, a successful invasion would have required an international coalition. If you're going after Jesse James, you ought to organize the posse first, especially if you're in the middle of a gunfight with somebody else at the same time. Fourth, the coalition assembled in 1991 paid the vast majority of all of the significant costs of the war. This time, the American taxpayers have shouldered the cost of $700 billion and counting. Fifth, back in 1991, President George H.W. Bush purposely waited until after the midterm elections of 1990 in order to push for a vote at the beginning of the new Congress in 1991. President George W. Bush pushed for a vote in the fall of 2002, immediately before the midterm congressional elections. The second President Bush was demanding, in a high political season, that Congress speedily affirm that he had the necessary authority to proceed immediately against Iraq, regardless of subsequent developments or emerging circumstances. The timing of this sudden burst of urgency to take up this new cause as America's top priority, displacing our former top priority, the war against Osama bin Laden, was explained innocently by the White House chief of staff in his now well-known statement, "From a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August." Rather than making efforts to dispel concerns at home and abroad about the role of politics in the timing of his policy, the president was on the campaign trail 2 and 3 days a week, often publicly taunting Democrats with the political consequences of a no vote. The Republican National Committee ran prepackaged advertising based on the same theme, All of this apparently in accord with a political strategy explicitly described in a White House aide's misplaced computer disk. The strategy advised Republican operatives that their principal game plan for success in the election a few weeks away was to focus on the war. Vice President Cheney, meanwhile, indignantly described suggestions of any such thing as reprehensible and then quickly took this exact discussion of the war to the Rush Limbaugh show. I believe this foreshortening of deliberation in the Congress robbed the country of the time it needed for careful analysis of exactly what lay in front of it. Such consideration was all the more important because the administration failed to lay out an assessment of how it thought the course of a war would run, even while it gave free rein to persons both within and close to the administration to suggest at every opportunity that this would be an easy matter. The administration did not say much of anything to clarify its idea of what would follow a regime change or the degree of engagement that it was prepared to accept for the United States in the months and years after a regime change. The brazen use of the war vote in the midterm elections raised many doubts about the role that politics played in the calculations of some in the administration. And because they were raised, this became a problem for our country's effort to build a national consensus and an international coalition. To cite just one example, the German election campaign revealed a profound and troubling change in the attitude of the German electorate toward the United States. We also saw our most loyal ally, Tony Blair, fall into serious trouble with his electorate, in part because of similar doubts raised about his decision to join the invasion. When I and others asked the Bush administration what they planned to do in the aftermath of a speedy victory in the initial invasion of Iraq, Secretary Rumsfeld said that he wasn't certain we would have any responsibility at all. "That's for the Iraqis to come together and decide," Rumsfeld said. At that very moment, we now know he was attempting to shut down the program at the U.S. Army War College that was focused on post-invasion stabilization. He was also excluding from post-war planning the State Department team that was focused on nation-building. This should not have come as a total surprise. I vividly remember that during one of the campaign debates in 2000, moderator Jim Lehrer asked then-Governor George Bush whether or not America, after being involved in military action, should engage in any form of nation-building. Bush's answer was, "I don't think so. I think what we need to do is convince people who live in the lands they live in to build the nations. Maybe I'm missing something here. We're going to have kind of a nation-building corps in America? Absolutely not." We faced a choice about nation-building in a much larger context at the end of World War II. America's power in comparison with the rest of the world was even greater than it is now. The choice we made then was to become a co-founder of what we now think of as the post-war era, based on the concepts of collective security and defense manifested first and foremost in the United Nations. Through all the dangerous years that followed, we never abandoned our belief that what we were struggling to achieve was not bounded by our physical security, but extended to the unmet hopes of humankind. The absence of any enlightened nation building after World War I led directly to the conditions that made Germany vulnerable to fascism and the rise of Adolf Hitler and made all of Europe vulnerable to his evil designs. By contrast, after World War II, there was an enlightened vision embodied in the Marshall Plan, the UN, NATO, and all of the other nation-building efforts that in turn led directly to the conditions that fostered prosperity and American leadership throughout the world. It is no longer reasonable to expect any similar enlightened vision from the current administration. But it is not too late for subsequent administrations to return America to the long-standing mainstream of its position in relation to the rest of the world. The damage to be undone is vast, but the cost of continuing to perpetuate that damage is literally incalculable. Chapter 7. The Carbon Crisis. Our policies on the climate crisis and our overdependence on fossil fuels, especially foreign oil, illustrate what can happen to a great nation when reason is replaced by the influence of wealth and power. Indeed, all of the pathologies that have been explored earlier in this book, deception, secrecy, the politics of fear, the appeal of a crusade, and the substitution of raw power for knowledge and logic are on vivid display in our energy and environmental policies. The energy crisis and the climate crisis are inextricably linked, both in their causes and in their solutions. In order to deal with the planetary emergency caused by the rapid accumulation of man-made carbon dioxide, CO2, in the Earth's atmosphere, we must quickly address its principal cause, which is, of course, our civilization's tragic overdependence on burning massive quantities of carbon-based fuels. There are, in fact, multiple reasons why the United States should undertake a massive strategic effort to solve the climate crisis and the fossil fuel dependency crisis simultaneously. They are the same crisis. And the fact that we still have our heads in the sand is perhaps the single best example of how the decline of reason in our national discourse blinds us to our own self-interest. Coal and oil are especially harmful to the Earth's climate because of their high carbon content relative to each unit of energy derived from them. The CO2 produced as waste in the burning of fossil fuels, 70 million tons of it every day, traps part of the infrared energy re-radiated by the Earth into space. And coal is much worse than oil. Moreover, the other dirty carbon-based fuels found in large quantities in North America, tar sands and oil shale, are the worst of all. Any significant use of these CO2-laden deposits would make the climate crisis infinitely more difficult to solve. And the energy-intensive processing of coal, shale, and tar sands into liquid and gaseous forms would further complicate any effort to use them as alternatives to oil and natural gas. In the case of oil, the concentration of the largest source of cheaply recoverable reserves in what is arguably the least stable region of the world, the Persian Gulf, has led a growing number of Americans to the conclusion that renewable sources of energy should be developed quickly in order to avoid the disruptive consequences of suddenly losing access to affordable oil supplies. Actually, the largest supplier of oil to the United States is now Canada, and our second largest supplier is Mexico. Saudi Arabia is only our third largest supplier. The fourth largest is Venezuela. But the Persian Gulf still dominates the top of the list of world suppliers. And since the market for oil is largely integrated globally, any disruption of oil supplies or prices originating in the Persian Gulf would quickly have a cascading impact on the world market for oil and on the U.S. economy. By keeping world oil prices high, our steadily increasing consumption of oil also ensures the continued flow of petrodollars into the coffers of states like Iran, which are hostile to our interests, and Saudi Arabia, where significant sums have apparently been diverted to train and support terrorists. Our current excessive dependence on oil endangers not only our national security and the Earth's environment, but also our economic security. Anyone who believes that the international market for oil is a free market is seriously deluded. It does have many characteristics of a free market, but it is also subject to periodic manipulation by the group of nations controlling the largest recoverable reserves, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, sometimes in concert with the small group of companies that dominate the global production, refining, and distribution network. It is extremely important for us to be clear among ourselves that these episodic manipulations have not one objective, but two. First of all, these producing nations naturally seek to maximize profits. But more significant, they also seek to manipulate our political will. And for the last 30 years, they have paid careful attention to the need for price reductions every time the West comes close to recognizing the wisdom of developing adequate supplies of our own independent sources of renewable fuels. We need to face the fact that our dangerous and unsustainable consumption of oil from a highly unstable part of the world is similar in its consequences to other forms of self-destructive behavior. The longer it continues, the greater the harm and the more serious the risk. By now, it is pretty obvious to most Americans that we have had one too many wars in the Persian Gulf, where our troops have been sent for the second time in a dozen years, at least partly to ensure our continued access to oil. And it is equally obvious that we need an urgent effort to develop environmentally sustainable substitutes for fossil fuels and a truly international effort to stabilize the Persian Gulf and rebuild Iraq. Since oil became the key source of energy for industrial economies and militaries a century ago, ensuring access to the largest reserves has been a key factor in strategic planning by the United States and other great powers, in peacetime and especially in wartime. As documented in Chapter 4, many feel that one of the hidden reasons for launching the war in Iraq in early 2003 was the oft-stated and long-held opinion of Vice President Dick Cheney and others that ensuring continued U.S. access to the easily recoverable oil reserves of the Persian Gulf is so important as to justify even the extraordinary cost and reckless risk to America's reputation of invading another country on false pretenses. The same instinct for deception that everyone now realizes was a prominent part of the launching of the war in Iraq was also obvious in the way the Bush White House removed the climate crisis from its agenda of problems to address immediately after the inauguration. In fact, we now know that during the first weeks of the administration, Vice President Cheney began meeting with his infamous Energy Task Force and secretly advised lobbyists for polluters that the White House would take no action on global warming. He then asked for their help in designing a totally meaningless voluntary program. In an effort to explain why they should waste time on the seemingly irrelevant voluntary program, one of the utility industry's top air pollution lobbyists, Quinn Shea of the Edison Electric Institute, made unguarded comments to a coal industry group. "Let me put it to you in political terms," Shea said in April 2001, unaware that his comments were being transcribed. "The president needs a fig leaf. He's dismantling Kyoto, but he's out there on a limb." A fig leaf. Bush's solemn promise to the American people during the 2000 campaign that CO2 would be regulated as a polluting greenhouse gas was instantly abandoned only days after the inauguration. He replaced it with a promise to the largest polluters that CO2 would not be regulated at all. Similarly, his seemingly heartfelt declaration to the American people during the campaign that he genuinely believed global warming was a real problem was replaced immediately after the inauguration by a dismissive expression of contempt for all of the careful, peer-reviewed work by the Environmental Protection Agency scientists who had presented for his review the plain facts about the dangers of the climate crisis. "I read the report put out by the bureaucracy," Bush responded when reporters asked him in the Oval Office about the report. Although the president finally used the phrase climate change in his 2007 State of the Union address, the slight rhetorical shift was not accompanied by any real policy change, at least not yet. In the same way, the promise by candidate Bush in 2000 to conduct a humble foreign policy and avoid any effort at nation building was transformed in the first days of the Bush presidency, according to newly available evidence from eyewitnesses, into a methodical, secret search for any excuse to invade Iraq at the earliest opportunity. Later, during the invasion itself, even as looters were carrying off many of Iraq's priceless antiquities from museums designed to commemorate the cradle of civilization, only one government building was protected by American troops, the Petroleum Ministry. In 2007, even as Iraq was disintegrating into sectarian violence, the Bush administration was carefully crafting legal documents while the United States was still the occupying power, guaranteeing preferential access to the enormous profits expected from production of Iraq's vast oil reserves for ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, and Shell. Critics like Greg Muttit of the human rights and environmental group Platform, which monitors the oil industry, described the proposed law as a terrible deal for Iraqis and regional citizens who were totally cut out of the process. The draft went to the U.S. government and major oil companies in July 2006, Muttit said in January 2007, and to the International Monetary Fund in September. Last month, I met a group of 20 Iraqi MPs in Jordan and I asked them how many had seen the legislation. Only one had. Many Americans are realizing the folly of borrowing huge amounts of money from China to buy huge amounts of oil from the Persian Gulf and to make huge amounts of pollution that destroy the planet's climate. Increasingly, most Americans believe that we have to change every part of that equation. Imported oil represents the largest single category of our enormous trade deficit. In 2006, more than 40% of the total deficit came from the purchase of foreign oil. When I visit port cities like Seattle, New Orleans, or Baltimore, I find the same sad story. Many massive ships running low in the water, heavily burdened with foreign cargo or foreign oil, arrive by the thousands. These same cargo ships and tankers depart, riding high with only ballast water to keep them from rolling over. Instead of goods, we send money electronically in the appropriate direction. One-way trade is destructive to our economic future. We can change this by inventing and manufacturing new solutions to stop global warming right here in America. I still believe in good old-fashioned American ingenuity. We need to fill those ships with new products and technologies that we create to turn down the global thermostat. But we must begin by winning the first battle against inertia and the fear of change. And that means we have to understand exactly what we're up against. More than a quarter century ago, when I was still in the U.S. House of Representatives, I began an intensive study of nuclear arms control, and in the process spent a lot of time with military theorists and experts on nuclear strategy. One of the many insights they shared with me had to do with the topography of military conflicts. All conflicts fall, generally speaking, into one of three basic categories: local battles, that may or may not have some larger strategic significance but are largely confined to a small area; regional conflicts, or wars, that range across a larger area and typically involve the crossing of multiple geopolitical boundary lines; and strategic or global conflicts that, while far less common, can significantly alter the course of history. Later, I came to see that environmental challenges also fall naturally into three similar categories, each requiring a different way of thinking and responding. Most of the environmental issues people deal with are essentially local in nature: water pollution, air pollution, toxic waste dumps. In the last several decades, as environmental awareness expanded, we began to focus on a newly recognized class of regional environmental threats. Acid rain, originating largely from Midwestern smokestacks and affecting the entire northeastern United States. An enormous dead zone, affecting a huge portion of the Gulf of Mexico and caused by the runoff of agricultural chemicals from the nation's breadbasket that are carried south by the Mississippi River past New Orleans. And the rapid and unsustainable depletion of underground freshwater supplies in the Ogallala Aquifer, which lies underneath 8 states in the high plains between the Mississippi Basin and the Rocky Mountains. Then, there is the relatively rare but potentially devastating category of environmental threats that are strategic or global in nature. The Bush administration has abandoned its responsibility to protect the environment in all three of these categories and has essentially given control of environmental policy to the largest polluters and other special interests, many of whom have tried for decades to weaken or gut environmental standards. Take, for example, the Bush administration's handling of mercury, an extremely toxic pollutant causing severe developmental and neurological defects in fetuses. Even Bush's own Food and Drug Administration issued warnings about the consumption of mercury in tuna, swordfish, halibut, and other long-lived deep-water fishes that bioconcentrate mercury. We know that the principal unregulated source of mercury pollution is coal-fired power plants. But the Bush administration has gutted the protections of the Clean Air Act that used to limit mercury by modifying the Clean Air Act to allow polluters to avoid actually having to reduce mercury. They are, of course, extremely hazardous, but the coal and utility industries persuaded the Bush White House to pretend that they aren't, and then to overrule the scientists. To take another example, the cleanup of toxic waste dumps has come to a virtual halt. The Superfund, which I helped to establish in 1980 when I was in the Congress, was designed to provide funding for the protection of those affected by hazardous dumps. But the Bush administration has allowed the fund to dwindle from $3.8 billion to a shortfall of $175 million. The result, as predicted, is fewer cleanups, slower cleanups, and a toxic mess left for our children. That's because the Bush administration has let its industry friends off the hook. The tax these polluters used to pay to support the Superfund has been eliminated, so taxpayers are left holding the bill. We have also seen a radical change in the stewardship of America's national parks. Although the president requested an increase in money for parks in the 2008 budget, many feel it is too little too late, especially since his policies have allowed harmful exploitation of the parks. A coalition of more than 100 retired career National Park Service employees wrote a letter not long ago saying that the mission of the Park Service to protect parks' natural resources has been changed in favor of focusing instead on commercial and special interest use of parks. To mention only one example, we've seen Bush and Cheney work tirelessly to allow their friends to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. These are not small shifts in policy. They are radical changes that reverse a century of American commitments to protect our natural resources. Yellowstone Park was created in 1872 in part to preserve its forest, mineral, and geothermal resources. Theodore Roosevelt in 1906 championed this philosophy, setting aside millions of acres of forest reserves, national monuments, and wildlife refuges. The Clinton-Gore administration protected just as much land. This balanced approach, combining the use of needed resources in the short term with conservation for future generations, has been honored by every president since Roosevelt on down the line until this one. When it comes to enforcing environmental laws, the Bush administration consistently chooses special interests over its obligation to protect the American people from pollution. It regularly ignores scientific evidence in favor of unproven assertions by large polluters that are among its supporters. A recent review of contributions to the Bush campaign from utility industry executives, lawyers, and lobbyists showed that 10 Bush pioneers, those who raised at least $100,000 for the Bush campaign, came from these industries and their trade associations. The Bush administration has also frequently sought to slash enforcement personnel levels at the EPA. Enforcement offices have also been warned not to pursue certain cases. The Bush administration announced in 2006 that it was dropping the investigations of 50 power plants for violating the Clean Air Act, a move that Senator Chuck Schumer said basically announced to the power industry that it can now pollute with impunity. Rich Biondi, a veteran EPA official, quit after concluding that he was being prevented from doing his job effectively. "The rug was pulled out from under us," Biondi said. The best known and by far most serious of the strategic environmental threats is the climate crisis. For me, this issue is in a special category because of what I believe is at stake. I am particularly concerned because the vast majority of the most respected environmental scientists from all over the world have sounded a clear and urgent alarm. The international community, including the United States, began a massive effort several years ago to assemble the most accurate scientific assessment of the growing evidence that the Earth's environment is sustaining severe and potentially irreparable damage from the unprecedented accumulation of pollution in the global atmosphere. In essence, these scientists are telling the people of every nation that global warming caused by human activities has become a serious threat to our common future and must be confronted. I am also troubled that the Bush-Cheney administration does not seem to hear the warnings of the scientific community in the same way that most of us do. In spite of the clear evidence available all around us, There are many who still do not believe that global warming is a problem at all. And it's no wonder, because they are the targets of a massive and well-organized campaign of disinformation, pushed by the administration and lavishly funded by polluters who are determined to prevent any action to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming, out of a fear that their profits might be affected if they have to stop dumping so much pollution into the atmosphere. Wealthy right-wing ideologues have joined with the most cynical and irresponsible companies in the oil, coal, and mining industries to contribute large sums of money to finance pseudoscientific front groups that specialize in sowing confusion in the public's mind about global warming. They issue one misleading report after another, pretending that there is significant disagreement in the legitimate scientific community in areas where there is actually a broad-based consensus. The techniques they use were pioneered years earlier by the tobacco industry in its long campaign to create uncertainty in the public's mind about the health risks caused by tobacco smoke. Indeed, some of the very same scientific camp followers who took money from the tobacco companies during that effort are now taking money from coal and oil companies in return for their willingness to say that global warming is not real. In early 2007, just as the new international scientific report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, was being released, one of these front groups, financed by ExxonMobil, offered $10,000 for each pseudo-study or paper disputing the findings of the scientific community. This strategy has been followed for decades by the largest polluters. In a candid memo about political strategy for Republican leaders, pollster Frank Luntz expressed concern that voters might punish candidates who supported more pollution, but he offered advice on the key tactic for diffusing the issue. Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate. The Bush administration has gone far beyond Luntz's recommendations, however. In the case of the global climate crisis, Bush has publicly demeaned scientists in his own administration who author official reports that underscore the extreme danger facing the United States and the world. Instead, he has preferred a self-interested and deeply flawed analysis financed by the largest oil company on the planet, ExxonMobil. He even went so far as to censor elements of an EPA report dealing with global warming and substitute in the official government report language from the ExxonMobil document. The consequences of accepting ExxonMobil's advice to do nothing to counter global warming are almost unthinkable. ExxonMobil has been particularly influential with the current administration and has been more active than any other polluter in its brazen efforts to try to manage public perceptions of the reality and seriousness of the climate crisis. Numerous organizations devoted to scientific integrity have blown the whistle on ExxonMobil's disgraceful practices, but thus far with little effect. The Royal Society, the UK's equivalent of the National Academy of Sciences, formally renewed its request that ExxonMobil stop disseminating to the public very misleading and inaccurate information that is not consistent with what is accepted in the scientific community about the climate crisis. The Royal Society also called upon ExxonMobil to stop paying millions of dollars per year to organizations that misrepresented the science of climate change by outright denial of the evidence that greenhouse gases are driving climate change, or by overstating the amount and significance of uncertainty in knowledge, or by conveying a misleading impression of the potential impacts of anthropogenic climate change. Another organization of scientists, the U.S.-based Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS, prepared a lengthy report in 2006 showing that ExxonMobil has funneled nearly $16 million between 1998 and 2005 to a network of 43 advocacy organizations that seek to confuse the public on global warming science. ExxonMobil has manufactured uncertainty about the human causes of global warming, just as tobacco companies denied their product caused lung cancer, said Alden Meyer, UCS Director of Strategy and Policy. A modest but effective investment has allowed the oil giant to fuel doubt about global warming, to delay government action, just as big tobacco did for over 40 years. Two United States senators, Republican Olympia Snowe from Maine and Democrat Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia, also joined in the growing effort to persuade ExxonMobil to behave ethically. The two senators said that ExxonMobil's brazen and outrageous effort to spread ignorance and confusion about the climate crisis has damaged the United States' reputation, saying that ExxonMobil's ongoing misrepresentation of the science is not honest. They protested ExxonMobil's extensive funding of an echo chamber of non-peer-reviewed pseudoscience. ExxonMobil's motive for engaging in this extraordinary and ongoing effort at mass deception is certainly not mysterious. In early 2007, the company announced the largest annual profit for the preceding year, 2006, of any corporation in U.S. history. The company directors have long since concluded that efforts to solve the climate crisis and the energy crisis are not in their best interest. They have also lavishly rewarded their executives for suppressing any qualms they might have experienced at being so dishonest. Former CEO Lee Raymond was given a retirement package worth $400 million. He was then promptly named by President Bush as the chair of a committee to lead a key study examining America's alternative energy future. Indeed, it seems at times as if the Bush-Cheney administration is wholly owned by the coal, oil, utility, and mining companies. The problem is that our world is now confronting a five-alarm fire that calls for bold moral and political leadership from the United States of America. As the human population quadrupled in the previous century from 1.6 billion in 1900 to 6.6 billion today, and as new technologies multiplied the average impact of each person on the Earth's environment thousands of times over, the fundamental relationship between the human species and planet Earth was radically altered. Our footprint can now be measured not only by the impact of all the CO2 we are pumping daily into the Earth's atmosphere, but also by our careless destruction of one football field's worth of forest on the surface of the planet every second of every day. It can be measured also in the destruction of ocean fisheries and the pending threat of human-caused extinctions at current rates of exploitation for virtually every important ocean species in less than a half century. One of the first crises in the strategic category of global environmental threats was the depletion of the stratospheric ozone layer, a global crisis of the atmosphere caused by the sudden increase of man-made chlorine compounds in the course of a few decades that led to a 600% increase in the concentration of chlorine atoms in the entire atmosphere of the planet. The most serious manifestation of this crisis was the appearance of a U.S.-sized ozone hole in the stratosphere high above Antarctica every astral fall, September through November. But the thinning of the ozone layer occurred, and is still occurring, worldwide. What stratospheric ozone depletion shares in common with global warming is that in both cases, the chemical substance causing the problem is invisible and produces its threatening consequences in the global dimension. What the strategic environmental threats have in common with strategic or global military conflicts is the necessity of an all-out global mobilization as the only means of ensuring that the outcome brings a positive future for human civilization. In order to conquer our fear and walk boldly forward on the path that lies before us, we have to insist on a higher level of honesty in America's political dialogue. When we make big mistakes in America, it is usually because the people have not been given an honest accounting of the choices before us. It also is usually because too many leaders in both parties who knew better did not have the courage to do better. Our children have a right to hold us to a higher standard when their future, indeed the future of all human civilization, is hanging in the balance. They deserve better than the spectacle of censorship of the best scientific evidence about the truth of our situation and harassment of honest scientists who are trying to warn us about the looming catastrophe. They deserve better than politicians who sit on their hands and do nothing to confront the greatest challenge that humankind has ever confronted, even as the danger bears down on us. In 2006 and 2007, scientists reached a newer and stronger consensus that global warming is increasing the destructive power of hurricanes by as much as one half of one full category on the 1-5 scale typically used by forecasters. So in Florida, a hurricane hitting in the future that would have been a Category 3 in the past will, on the average, become a Category 4 hurricane. Scientists around the world are also alarmed by what appears to be an increase in the rate of CO2 buildup in the atmosphere, a development that, if confirmed in subsequent years, could potentially signal the beginning of an extremely dangerous runaway greenhouse effect. Another respected scientific team reported that under the business-as-usual scenario, the entire Arctic ice cap could melt and be completely gone in summer within as little as 34 years. Even though I have studied this crisis for more than 40 years, I still am shocked by some new findings. That is one of them. Yet President Bush continues to rely for his scientific advice on global warming on the one company that most stands to benefit by delaying a recognition of reality. In 2006, new information showed dramatic increases in the burning of forests throughout the American West, a trend that has increased decade by decade as warmer temperatures have dried out soils and vegetation. All these findings came at the end of a summer with record-breaking temperatures and the hottest year ever recorded in the United States, with persistent drought in vast areas of our country. Many scientists are now warning that we are moving closer to several tipping points that could, within as little as 10 years, make it impossible for us to avoid irretrievable damage of the planet's habitability for human civilization. In this regard, another group of scientists reported on the surprisingly rapid increases in the release of carbon and methane emissions from frozen tundra in Siberia, now beginning to thaw because of human-caused increases in global temperature. Similarly, in 2006, yet another team of scientists reported that the previous 12 months saw 32 glacial earthquakes on Greenland that measured between 4.6 and 5.1 on the Richter scale, a disturbing sign that a massive destabilization could well be underway deep within the second largest accumulation of ice on the planet, capable of raising sea level 20 feet worldwide if it broke up and slipped into the sea. Each passing day brings yet more evidence that we are now facing a planetary emergency, a climate crisis that demands immediate action to sharply reduce carbon dioxide emissions worldwide in order to turn down the Earth's thermostat and avert catastrophe. In the lead article in its special issue on global warming in September 2006, Scientific American offered the following simple conclusion: the debate on global warming is over. Even though the Earth is of such vast size, the most vulnerable part of the global environment is the atmosphere, because it is surprisingly thin, like a coat of varnish on a globe, as the late Carl Sagan used to say. There is no longer any credible basis for doubting that the Earth's atmosphere is heating up because of global warming. Global warming is real. It is happening already, and the anticipated consequences are unacceptable. The one event in recent years that probably did more than anything else to convince Americans to look differently at the climate crisis was the catastrophic damage inflicted by Hurricane Katrina. As we all watched the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina unfold, we all had a lot of different thoughts and feelings. But all those feelings were mixed in with puzzlement at why there was no immediate response and why there was not an adequate plan in place. We were told that this was not a time to point fingers, even as some of those saying, "don't point fingers," were themselves pointing fingers at the victims of the tragedy who did not, many of whom could not, evacuate the city of New Orleans because they didn't have automobiles and they did not have adequate public transportation. We were told this was not a time to hold our national government accountable because there were more important matters that confronted us. But this is not an either-or choice. They are linked together. As our nation belatedly found effective ways to help those who were so hard hit by Hurricane Katrina, it was important to learn the right lessons from what happened, lest we were spoon-fed the wrong lessons. After all, if we do not absorb the right lessons from history, we are, in the historian's phrase, doomed to repeat the mistakes that have already been made. All of us know that our nation failed the people of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast when Hurricane Katrina was approaching them and when it struck. When the corpses of American citizens are floating in toxic floodwaters 5 days after hurricane strikes, it is time not only to respond directly to the victims of the catastrophe, but to hold the processes of our nation accountable and the leaders of our nation accountable for the failures that have taken place. 4 years before Katrina, in August 2001, President Bush received a dire warning. Al-Qaeda determined to strike inside the U.S. No meetings were called, no alarms were sounded, and no one was brought together to say, what else do we know about this imminent threat? What can we do to prepare our nation for what we have been warned is about to take place? If members of the administration had been prepared, they would have found a lot of information collected by the FBI, the CIA, and the National Security Agency, including the names of most of the terrorists who flew those planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the field in Pennsylvania. They would have discovered that various FBI field offices had issued warnings of suspicious characters getting flight training without expressing any curiosity about the part of the training that has to do with landing. They would have found directors of FBI field offices in a state of agitation about the fact that there was no terrorism plan in place and no effective preparations for a response. Instead, it was vacation time, not a time for preparation or protecting the American people. 4 years later, there were dire warnings, 3 days before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, that if it followed the path it was then on, the levees would break, and the city of New Orleans would drown, and thousands of people would be at risk. It was once again vacation time, and the preparations were not made, the plans were not laid, the response was not forthcoming. I believe that the very fact that there has been no accountability for the horrendous misjudgments and outright falsehoods that laid the foundation for the horrible tragedy that we have ongoing in Iraq is one of the principal reasons there was no fear of being held accountable for a cavalier, lackluster, mistaken, and inadequate response to the onrushing tragedy in New Orleans. After all, it was clearly visible for those who were watching television and for those who were reading the news. What happened was not only knowable, it was known, in advance, in great and painstaking detail. Emergency management officials had even done tabletop planning exercises and identified exactly what would take place according to the scientific evidence. But members of the administration ignored all of that. Where there is no vision, the people perish. It's not only that there was no vision, it's that there has been a misguided vision. The Bush administration has appeared to be determined to weaken and diminish the ability of the federal government to do its job. After all, there had been warnings 3 years before Katrina hit New Orleans from James Lee Witt, director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the Clinton-Gore administration, that FEMA was being rendered weak and helpless, and would be unable to respond in the event of a catastrophe unless adequate resources were restored to it. But administration officials didn't listen. The budget was cut, and the resources were sent elsewhere, mainly back to wealthy taxpayers in the form of disproportionate tax cuts. Carl Pope, executive director of the Sierra Club, said he was embarrassed by the horror in New Orleans. Embarrassed is a tricky word when it comes to describing the feelings of Americans about the policies and actions of our government. I'm not sure that any single word is entirely adequate to describe the feelings that many had after the invasion of Iraq when they saw American soldiers holding dog leashes attached to helpless prisoners, 99% of whom were innocent of any connection to terrorism or violence against our troops. They were innocent prisoners who were being tortured in our name. What did you feel? I don't know the words to describe my own feelings. But I would like all Americans to draw a line connecting the feelings they had when they saw the visual images of our soldiers acting in our name with our authority, torturing helpless people, and it was a matter of policy, even though the White House pointed fingers at the privates and corporals and said it was all their responsibility, with the emotions they felt during Hurricane Katrina when they saw those corpses in the water, people without food, water, medicine, our fellow citizens left helpless. And of course, in both cases, the story is complex and many factors are involved, but I want people to draw a line connecting the feelings they had in both situations. And then I want them to draw another line connecting those responsible for both unbelievable tragedies that embarrassed our nation in the eyes of the world. Connect those who ignored the warnings about Katrina and then bungled the aftermath with those who ignored the warnings not to invade Iraq and then bungled the aftermath. And the line makes a small circle. In the middle of that circle is President George W. Bush. There are scientific warnings now of another onrushing catastrophe. We were warned of an imminent attack by Al-Qaeda. We didn't respond. We were warned the levees would break in New Orleans. We didn't respond. Now the scientific community is warning us of the worst catastrophe in the history of human civilization. 2,000 scientists in 100 countries engaged in the most elaborate, well-organized scientific collaboration in the history of humankind have long since produced a consensus that we will face a string of terrible catastrophes unless we act to prepare ourselves and deal with the underlying causes of global warming. In February 2007, this group, the IPCC, further strengthened its consensus to say there is a 90% probability that humans are responsible for global warming. It is important to learn the lessons of what happens when scientific evidence and clear authoritative warnings are ignored, in order to induce our leaders not to do it again, not to ignore the scientists and leave us unprotected in the face of those threats that are facing us right now. The president says that he is not sure humans are responsible for the threat of global warming. He is not ready to do anything meaningful to prepare us for a threat that he's not certain is real. He tells us that he believes the science of global warming is in dispute. This is the same president who said after the devastation of New Orleans, nobody could have predicted that the levees would break. It is important to establish accountability in order to make our democracy work. All the uncertainty and lack of resolution, the willful misunderstanding of what the scientific community is saying, the preference for what a few of his supporters in the coal and oil industries, far from all but a few, want him to do, ignore the science, have created a serious problem. While New Orleans was still waiting for a White House response, the president went to an event in California designed to build support for his policy in Iraq, and drew an analogy between his decision to invade and Franklin Roosevelt's handling of World War II. Let me offer another analogy to World War II. When the storm was gathering over continental Europe, Winston Churchill provided warnings of what was at stake. He said this about the government then in power in England, which wasn't sure that the threat was real. They go on in strange paradox, decided only to be undecided. Resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, all-powerful to be impotent. The era of procrastination, of half-measures, of soothing and baffling expedients, of delays, is coming to a close. In its place, we are entering a period of consequences. The warnings about global warming have been extremely clear for a long time. We are facing a global climate crisis. It is deepening. We are entering a period of consequences. Churchill said something else, directed at the people of his country who were looking for any way to avoid having to really confront the threat he was warning of and asking them to prepare for. He said that he understood why there was a natural desire to deny the reality of the situation and to search for vain hope that it wasn't as serious as some claimed it was. But he said they should know the truth. And after the appeasement by Neville Chamberlain, he said, "This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup, which will be proffered to us year by year unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor, we arise again and take our stand for freedom. It is time now for us to recover our moral health in America and stand again for freedom, demand accountability for poor decisions, missed judgments, lack of planning, lack of preparation, and willful denial of the obvious truth about serious and imminent threats that are facing the American people. And we must reject the false lessons being offered to us as explanations for the horrendous tragedy of Hurricane Katrina. Some, including some in the current administration, are now saying that the pitiful response by government proves that we cannot ever rely on the government. Yet FEMA worked extremely well during the previous administration. The fact that this administration can't manage its own way out of a horse show doesn't mean that all government programs should be abolished. They have in the past proposed more unilateral power for themselves as the solution to a catastrophe of their own creation. But we should not give them more power to abuse and misuse the way they have so recently done. We should hold them accountable, and we should demand that they acknowledge the scientific evidence and respect the rule of reason. 100 years ago, Upton Sinclair wrote, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." Here's what I think we understand about Hurricane Katrina and global warming. Yes, it is true that no single hurricane can be blamed on global warming. Hurricanes have come for a long time and will continue to come in the future. Yes, it is true that the science does not definitively tell us that global warming increases the frequency of hurricanes, because yes, it is true, there is a multi-decadal cycle, a cycle of 20 to 40 years, that profoundly affects the number of hurricanes that come in any single hurricane season. But it is also true that the science is extremely clear now that warmer oceans make the average hurricane stronger, not only make the wind stronger, but dramatically increase the moisture evaporating from the oceans into the storm, thus magnifying its destructive power, and makes the intensity of the hurricane stronger. The newscasters told us after Hurricane Katrina went over the southern tip of Florida that there was a particular danger for the Gulf Coast of the hurricanes becoming much stronger because it was passing over unusually warm waters in the Gulf. And indeed, the waters in the Gulf have been unusually warm. The oceans generally have been getting warmer. And the pattern is exactly consistent with what scientists have predicted for 20 years. They now say that the average hurricane will continue to get stronger because of global warming. A scientist at MIT published a study well before this tragedy showing that since the 1970s, hurricanes in both the Atlantic and the Pacific have increased in duration and in intensity.